Good afternoon, and welcome to the April meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout in Northport on the coast of Maine. And a particular welcome to our public radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the president of the forum. Since 1985, the forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of foreign service, journalism, or academia talk about the critical foreign policy issues facing the United States and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Today, the Midcoast Forum is honored to have Saad Eddine Ibrahim, one of Egypt's leading human rights and democracy activists, come talk to us. As a strong critic of former Egyptian President Mubarak, Dr. Ibrahim was arrested, imprisoned, and prosecuted in the year 2000 for election monitoring and for allegedly defaming Egypt's image abroad. He was sentenced to 7 years in prison. His defense team countered that the real motives behind the government's prosecution of him and his assistants was his outspoken criticism of President Mubarak and his administration. He was tried twice on the same charges in state security courts, winning each time on appeal. During a third trial before the highest civil court in Egypt in the year 2003, and this was after a storm of international protest against the Mubarak regime, he was cleared of all charges and released. Ironically, Mubarak's two sons are now in the same jail cell, 606, that Dr. Ibrahim was in for those 3 years. And to show how history repeats itself, his lawyer, who eventually succeeded in getting him released, is now the lawyer representing President Mubarak. In any case, after finally winning his appeal and being released, Saad spent most of the rest of Mubarak's rule in exile in the United States, and he spoke before the forum over 2 years ago in January of 2010. He returned to Egypt following Mubarak's overthrow last year and is here today, en route tonight, back to Europe and Egypt to bring us up to date on today's Egypt. So we're delighted and privileged to have one of the great figures of modern Egyptian history speaking to us today.
Good morning, good afternoon. It's morning, isn't it? Good morning. And thank you very much, Mac, for this very kind and generous introduction. And let me thank the forum for inviting me, for giving me this opportunity to visit your beautiful location here and to be hosted by Mac and Zahra. And the opportunity to share with you some of our joys and concerns nowadays. The term, the Arab Spring, has now become almost like a household term. The Tahrir Square in the center of Cairo has equally become a household term after the intensive coverage by all world media of the revolution in Egypt, which started on January 25th, 2011. When that revolution took place, I was in New Jersey. And we had no idea that it's going to be a revolution. It was to be just a demonstration, one of a series of demonstrations to make requests, collective requests, to abolish emergency laws, to get some modest reforms affected, to ask President Mubarak to stop running for the fifth time for the presidency. Modest requests However, the Mubarak regime, in its arrogance and obsession with power, denied even the most modest of these requests, which escalated the demands and brought about clashes between the demonstrators, who started peacefully, and the state security forces. And you must have seen all of that on television, because thanks to CNN, BBC, and other world media, it brought all of these events to every home around the world. People were very impressed by the size of the crowds, by the persistence of the crowd, by the creativity of the young Egyptians who staged that revolution. I was called on that day to the White House, because I was in New Jersey, teaching in New Jersey. And when I arrived, there was a demonstration around the White House by fellow Egyptians living in the Washington area, a demonstration solidarity with their brothers and sisters back home. I knew many of the leaders of that demonstration, so I demonstrated with them for a while before I exited to the White House to meet with Mr. Obama's advisor, who had set a task force and an operation room to monitor the events in Egypt. And they felt that this is the crowd, the size of the crowd this time is bigger than usual. And having taken place nearly 1 month after an uprising in Tunisia that led to the ousting of Ben Ali, the president of Tunisia at the time, Americans took the situation in Egypt very seriously. So the White House was on edge, following the events minute by minute. President Obama would come to that situation room or operation room every half an hour or every hour to check on what was going on, and to get an assessment by the team of the top advisors of the president. Well, meanwhile, I was getting reports from my wife in Tahrir Square. She was there from the first minute. Not by design, but she happened to have been convening a meeting at the American University in Cairo, which is on Tahrir Square. They have a campus on Tahrir Square. And when she saw the size of the crowd coming over the bridge connecting Tahrir Square to the Giza side of Cairo, she alerted me that this is unusual, that the size is probably 10 times bigger than anything she had seen in the recent times. So after a while, I put her on the White House magnifying voice so the White House team can hear her own reports from Tahrir. And every hour she was giving us an update. Well, having been there from the first day, people recognized her. And I think on the sixth or seventh day, they asked her to address the crowd in Tahrir. And I'm giving you this personal account because it gives you a feeling of what was going on. Now, the Tahrir Square is a huge square, and there were four or five platforms. For every political faction has a platform of its own to speak on the issues and why they are in Tahrir and why they are demanding what they are demanding. There was a lot of agendas, but the one corner that persisted inviting her to come and speak from their platform was the Muslim Brothers. And she said, the Muslim Brothers wanted me as an American woman to address the crowd from their platform, what's happening in the world? And they said, well, exactly. What's happening in the world is Tahrir Square. Everybody is changing. Even us, the Muslim Brothers, are changing. We came on the fourth day. We were reluctant to participate. But when we saw that the crowd was growing by the hour, we decided, the young Muslim Brothers, not the elder Muslim brother, but the young Muslim brother, decided to defy their leadership and to join in the action. And now we are asking you to come and speak to us. Since your husband is not here with us, speak to us. So reluctantly she did, and she spoke. And they cheered everything she said, even if it was nonsense. People were in the mood to cheer anything. So every 2 minutes they would applaud her. And she was struggling in her broken Arabic. She's an American lady. And Arabic is her second language. So she was struggling in Arabic. She spoke probably for 5 minutes. She thought it was 5 hours, not 5 minutes, because of the struggle with the language. However, at the end of her speech, they demanded to see her husband. So she opened the microphone and the telephone to me in New Jersey, and I could hear the crowd cheering and saying, come back, come back, come back, Dr. Ibrahim, come back, Dr. Ibrahim. So in a very dramatic way, she said, you want him to come back? I said, yes. So again, in a very dramatic way, said, Saad, that's my name, come back. Tonight, I want you to be here in the square 12 hours from now. Go to Kennedy Airport, get on the plane to Cairo, a direct flight, and I'll be waiting for you in the airport to deliver you to the square, to Tahrir. I thought, my wife is flipping. Anyhow, after we hang it up, I called her again and said, what are you talking about? She said, yes. I said, it's not that easy to just fly on a... I said, look, tourism is down in Egypt. Egypt Air is probably two-thirds empty, so you'll find a place on the flight, and I will make sure that the ticket is waiting for you. So by the time it sounded plausible. I called my university in New Jersey, told them I'm leaving on emergency to Cairo. They all understood. Of course, everybody was following the news. And I did. I did go to Cairo that night. Once I got on the plane, it turned into a seminar. It was, yes, half empty. And probably the 60 or 70 people, passengers, all congregated toward the middle where I was sitting. And they turned it into a seminar, discussing what's going on, what to anticipate, and a lot of excitement, but also a lot of anxiety among these passengers, many of whom are American Egyptians, expatriates, some were travelers, and everybody was, again, as I said, very concerned about what's going on, but excited, concerned and excited. Well, we arrive, and my wife's and a big crowd was waiting for me in the airport, and they took me immediately from the airport to Tahrir Square, where they thought she must be an Ionic woman, strong American woman who would drag her husband from the United States back to Egypt. It was kind of ironic in a way, an Egyptian in America and then American in Cairo, and role reversal. She is a woman who's commanding and orchestrating everything. So anyhow, it's just a personal note on the review. What made that event a very exciting event is because what preceded the event, for many years, our part of the world was wondering whether we in the Arab world, are an exception to the rule. How come Eastern and Central Europe had a revolution? How come democratic revolutions? How come East Asia had a democratic revolution? How come Latin America had democratic revolutions? Why is the Arab world stagnant? Why are the Arabs stuck? And to put salt on the wound of that feeling of what's wrong with us, there was a series of articles and books by some eminent scholars talking about Arab exceptionalism. Is that somehow what applies anywhere else, the Arabs are the exception. It used to be the Muslims were the exception, but after Indonesia went through a democratic revolution and Malaysia and Turkey and so on, it narrowed down to the empty quarter. Somehow one fourth of the Muslim world are Arabs, and those of you who have served in the Arab world know what an empty quarter is. It is a corner of Saudi Arabia that is completely lifeless, and it's called the empty quarter. So the expression, the empty quarter in the Muslim world was the Arab quarter, metaphorically and literally, that somehow the Arabs are not really with it somehow. So when the revolution in Tunisia took place, many of us sighed relief that, well, after all, it seems that we are like everybody else, have the same yearning for freedom, for democracy. And then a month later, it happened in Egypt, and then a month later in Libya, and then a month later in Yemen, and now in Bahrain, and now it is in Syria. In Syria, it is a very nasty transition, but it is happening everywhere in the Arab world. And hence, the term the Arab Spring is a well-deserved term. I think it's going to succeed. I think the rest of the Arab world will witness one after the other this kind of democratic transition. And in some parts of the Arab world will be a bloody one, like it is happening now in Syria. And the longer rulers had been in power, the bloodier it will get before they leave their power. And that's what I call the Ceausescu scenario. Do you remember Romania? Anybody from Romania here? From Bulgaria, I was. My fellow Bulgarian probably can testify to his neighbor, Romania. Romania was an interesting case because all of Eastern Europe had moved one after the other to democracy, bringing down totalitarian communist rule, except Romania. Romania remained to the end. And every time there was a democratic revolution in one of the Eastern European countries, Mr. Ceausescu will take a trip abroad, come back triumphantly, saying, Romania is unique. Romania is not like the rest. Until he came one day, he was visiting Iran. So here is a communist visiting an Islamic theological state, Iran, and coming back, and again, crowds meeting him in the airport, and then in a big rally in the center of the capital, And he goes out on the balcony to address the crowd. And the crowd, you know, orchestrated and organized like it happens usually in communist countries. But his wife said, you know, Nikolai, I hear one corner in the square cheering for freedom. He dismissed it in the beginning. And then she, a minute later, said, Nikolai, the crowd is getting bigger, shouting for freedom. It took about three times before he really realized there was something in that square cheering for freedom. So he withdraws from the balcony, gets inside, called his security forces to send three or four battalions to the square to put down those who are cheering for freedom. Meanwhile, the cheer was getting bigger and bigger in the square to the point where his wife thought it was unsafe to remain in the building overlooking that square. So they withdrew, they took a car, and he went out to meet the security battalions, special battalions, to lead them to suppress those who are cheering for freedom. However, he kept driving with his motorcade, looking for the would-be contingent that will come to put down, and he kept driving, driving, until he got to the border with Bulgaria, and there was no battalion. Meanwhile, the farmers who had been tuned on radio saw his motorcade, so they came out from the fields, blocked his motorcade, surrounded it, arrested him, and informed the revolutionaries in the capital that he was under arrest. And in that afternoon, he was tried and he was executed. And that was it. And I'm saying we saw a preview of that scenario in Libya. And we are going to see it in Syria. Not that I like to see these guys slaughtered or killed the way it was brutally done in Libya, but when they defy history, when they defy their people, they make it inevitable to end that way. I don't want to end on a depressing note, but I'm saying that the Arab Spring is poised to succeed and to spread, and that part of the world will become democratic, and mark my words, the rest of it, within the next 5 to 10 years, the whole region will become democratic. Why is that important to Americans? Well, one, the region is very rich in resources, especially oil, and you depend on Middle Eastern oil. Second, it is strategically located, and the U.S. need that part of the world to be on its side. Third, because of Israel. And Israel is a darling of the United States, and therefore it is important for the United States to closely observe, monitor, and create some kind of a dialogue with these new revolutions for the sake of its own interest, for the sake of Israel, for the sake of peace, and if they're planning to bomb Iran, they better make sure that the Arab world will not rise against it. So there are many reasons why you should take interest in what's going on in the Arab world. There are reasons to celebrate democracy since you are a democratic country, and since many of my generation learned many of the values, American values, for freedom, free speech, human rights, and therefore it is both your interest and your moral obligation to keep in close touch with what's happening in the Middle East and to support the new voices, the young people, because this revolution is only staged by young people, young crowds. And that's actually what swayed Mr. Obama after a few days of his hesitation in supporting the revolution. I said, Mr. President, these are the same people, same young people, like their American counterpart, who brought you to the White House. And I think it was this, among other things, that made him realize. I said, that's the history. Mubarak, because the other team of advisors were saying, how could we turn against a loyal ally like Mubarak, who has been with us for 30 years? My counter argument was, well, you have supported Mubarak for 30 years. It is about time to support the Egyptian people for 1 year. And it is young people, like the ones who brought you the White House, are the ones who are now fighting, demonstrating, and sitting in Tahrir Square to remove a man who was the third longest ruler in 6,000 years of Egyptian history. 6,000 years, he was the third longest. The first longest was Ramses II. He ruled for 42 years. The second longest was a Turkish ruler by the name of Muhammad Ali, who ruled for 40 years. And the third was Hosni Mubarak. So it was about time that he moved. He had survived at least 5 American presidents, and the people just got tired. Not only did he rule for a long time, but he became very abusive toward the end. And this speaker is one of thousands of victims that were put in prison or were killed by Mubarak and by his security apparatus. So we have an Arab Spring of freedom. That Arab Spring will spread. It deserves your attention. It deserves your support. And if you are true to your own values, and if you are keen on protecting your interest, then you must support the young Arab revolutionaries to prevail and to start a new era of peace and prosperity in the Middle East. And with this note, I thank you again, and I'll be glad to receive some questions. Thank you.
So that's terrific. Thank you very much. Let me start with the first question. Could the Muslim Brotherhood lead or be a part of a government that continues cooperation with Israel and the United States as the Mubarak government did for 32 years?
The answer, yes, for the United States. A conditional yes for Israel. Yes, for the United States, the Muslim Brothers are very pragmatic, and some of their leaders were prison mates, and we talked about a lot of things in prison. In prison, you have all the time in the world to debate and to talk. So, among other things, I had occasions to raise similar questions, and their deputy leader, by the name of Khaled Shatter, was with me in prison. And I saw him after the revolution. And he was willing to deal with the United States. And in fact, when former President Carter came for a visit, and Senator McCain came to visit, we arranged for both of them to meet with the Muslim Brothers, who in fact are about 100 meters from my office, Ibn Khaldun Center. I have an NGO called the Ibn Khaldun Center, and the headquarter of the Muslim Brother is exactly 100 meters away, even, well, one side of the street. On the other side, we have one of Cairo's most important mental hospitals. So jokingly, I say, one side of the street will drive us crazy, and the other side of the street will be kind to treat us when we get crazy. But yes, we can deal, and they will deal with anybody. They'll deal with the Americans, they will deal with the military. They have been waiting to get to that point for the last 60 plus years. The Muslim Brother is an old social movement, and they have been organizing, doing a lot of social services. They do not see eye to eye with people like myself, secularists, but you have to take them seriously. And now they are in power, and now they are willing to deal with everybody.
Okay, we've got a couple of sort of follow-up questions, and that is with the change, with the obvious candidate, the Muslim Brotherhood candidate, being told he could not run, how likely do you believe it is that the Muslim Brotherhood, the new Muslim Brotherhood candidate, will in fact be elected president?
He may. He had 50-50 chance. However, my own prediction is that it will not be a Muslim Brother president. It will be, there is a very potent candidate by the name of Amr Musa. He is a former minister of foreign affairs in Egypt, and he is also the former secretary general of the Arab League, Amr Musa. And he seemed to be in the lead, according to polls that have been conducted by my center, by the Ibn Khaldun Center. And he is in his mid-70s and very experienced diplomat. And he will be a decent president, not an exciting one, but a decent one. And I think he is likely to win among the other candidates.
Okay, here's a question about what Egyptians think and feel now about the United States' role in supporting Mubarak all those years, and about the ongoing United States support of the Egyptian military under Mubarak.
Well, most Egyptians are myopic about the United States. They like the United States in nearly everything. If you go to embassies in Cairo, foreign embassies, you'd find that the longest line applying for visas is in front of the American embassy. So regardless of what they say about the United States, or some of their critics say, at the end, it is the United States that most Egyptians like to visit, like to send their children to get education, like to do business in the United States. So the United States has nothing, the country, to fear about the attitude of Egyptians. If anything, that attitude has always been a positive one, with short periods of anti-Americanism when they blatantly side with Israel, or when they blatantly side with one of the oppressive rulers in the region. But generally, the attitude is fairly positive.
Okay, here's a follow-up. Since you mentioned Israel, how do you think Israel is going to react over the next couple of years to the Arab Spring?
Well, I've advised my Israeli friends to take advantage of that Arab Spring, that there hasn't been. One of the things I always asked my wife while I was here and she was in the square, three things. One, about the mix of the crowd. whether they're boys and girls, and what kind, if she can tell, what class. And third, how much anti-Americanism or anti-Israeli slogans are shouted in the square. And the answer was, you know, there are as many girls as boys. Second, that they are, seem to be all middle class, nicely dressed, college age or college graduates. And thirdly, there was very little or none anti-American and anti-Israeli slogans. People were really focused on the domestic scene, on the question of the presidency, governance, equity, democracy. And that remains, as I monitor the situation myself over the last year and 4 months, I find that the issue of Israel has kind of receded to the background. There is, of course, with the Muslim Brothers, there is sympathy with Hamas in Gaza, because Hamas is an extension of the Muslim Brother. It is the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brother. So they will be supportive of anything that Hamas goes for. And if Hamas, and that's what I advise my Israeli friends, to try to strike a compromise with Hamas, because once they do that, then the Muslim Brothers will come on board now that they are in power. And that remains to be the case. As I said, they are very pragmatic. And they have said they will respect all the treaties that previous regimes, both Mubarak, Nasser, and Sadat, have signed with foreign powers. And to that extent, the Egyptian-Israeli treaty is not in danger.
Okay, this is a question. You know, over the last couple of months, you've seen a lot of news reports about violence against Coptic Christians and that a lot of Copts have been leaving Egypt. So the question is, do you think Muslim versus Christian violence in Egypt will get worse, or is the worst behind us?
First of all, we have to put that in perspective. We monitor these things. And when they say the violence is on the increase, you may get the impression that tens or hundreds are being slaughtered every day. No, that's not Egypt. If one person gets killed, it is a big event in Egypt. And the victims of sectarian clashes are always ones, two, three, four, five, never really more than 10, 15 at any big time. So Christian, Coptic, Christian, Muslim have remained fairly sane over the last 1,400 years. So that is not going to change overnight because of that revolution or because of the ascendance of the Muslim Brothers. And the Muslim Brothers actually are very keen to deal cordially with the Copts because they know that the world's eyes are fixed on them. So there is nothing much to fear. However, it again, we should, Americans should be concerned and should always make, express that concern. So whoever is really is in power in Egypt would know that this is an issue that could not be pushed under the rug.
Okay, this is about, we're moving from Copts to women. How did this revolution engage the women of Egypt, and what effect is it likely to have on women's freedom in Egypt in the future?
I'm afraid not very positive. First of all, we have a cabinet that doesn't have many women in it. It has two women, but they are not Muslim sisters. They are secularists. And second, when they run candidates for the parliament, there were very few women candidates. Actually, among their list of candidates, there was no women at all. But some independent women Iran and won. So on that issue, there is a big deficit. And that should be always noted and criticized. Because women were very much part of the revolution, and yet they seem to be getting very little return. And that is not the first time that that happened. It happened elsewhere, that women will be on the forefront of wars of national liberation, of revolution. But when the dust settles, they find themselves with very little to show for their sacrifice. So I am concerned, and I am speaking against it. And for women, in my weekly article, and I have, in fact, advocated that 40% of all the seats in the next parliament should be reserved to people under 40 and for women, to divide 40%, because these were the ones who staged the revolution and who sustained it. And the least we can do is to stipulate in the Constitution that 40% of the seats should be occupied by people under 40 and half for women.
When you succeed in getting that done in Egypt, maybe you want to come and get it done here in the United States.
Inshallah, God willing.
All right, let's move slightly away from Egypt and take a broader look at the Middle East. Do you think the U.S. invasion of Iraq had any effect, in perhaps a negative way, but any effect in creating the Arab Spring?
I am afraid the answer is yes. My wife will kill me if I said that, if she knows I did. She was furious when, in a meeting like this, I likened the invasion of Iraq to the Napoleonic campaign on Egypt back in 1798, even though it was a failure, the campaign. Militarily was a failure, and he was forced to go back to France, yet those 3 years of the French expedition on Egypt changed the face of Egypt. We did not know our own ancient history until one of the scholars of that French campaign deciphered the Rosetta Stone. And through that, we began to read the writings on the walls of the temples and reconstruct our own history. Otherwise, my generation and at least 3 generations before me would have never known that they are the heirs of the great pharaohs. Even the word pharaoh was not known until we deciphered the Rosetta branch and stone. And that was done by one of the scholars of the French expedition in Egypt, Champollion, and there is a big street in his name still standing in Cairo. So I'm saying that to get to what happened was the American invasion of Iraq is similar. You had a ruthless ruler by the name of Saddam Hussein, and he had plunged Iraq in wars after wars. War with Iran for 10 years, invasion of Kuwait, war against the Kurds. This man was a ruthless. He was like, again, an Arab Hitler in many ways. Killed a lot of people from his own country and from neighboring countries. And he had very, very wild ambitions of dominating the Arab world. And that's why he invaded Kuwait, and next, he was to move to Saudi Arabia if it wasn't for the American military intervention. So I say that the invasion, getting rid of Saddam, at least opened the door for the Iraqis to evolve their own system. They will make mistakes. It definitely. And I think making mistake is a human right. Everybody is entitled to learn. And you can never learn without making mistakes. So I think the Iraqis now are on a bumpy road to reconstruct their country and to move forward. And I think all people in the region, Tunisians, Egyptians, Libyans, are on the same boat. It is a bumpy road, but at least they could see the end of the road, and the end of the road is a more democratic governance, and hopefully that will pave the way to peace and prosperity in the region in the long run.
Okay. Two more countries we want to ask you about. What will happen in Saudi Arabia? Any Arab Spring coming there? And how about in Jordan?
Well, Saudi Arabia has survived many upheavals. And they bought their way, the royal family, bribed its way out of the Arab Spring. You know how? You probably did not follow the news. But midway in the Arab Spring, the king decided that every Saudi will get 1 year salary bonus. So every Saudi who worked for the government, for any of the companies in Saudi Arabia, got 1 full year income as a bonus. Can you imagine that? Could you think, what would you do if you get the 1 year bonus? What would you do? Well, you would be very busy trying to think how to spend it instead of thinking of a revolution. At least for a year, you will not be thinking of a revolution. And the Saudi have done that. They have a lot of cash, a lot of money. As a matter of fact, they offered to bail President Mubarak out. They offered, you know, I think $10 billion loan or a grant to him, and in the hope that he could be saved. But it was too late. However, other than bribing their way out, they are beginning to reform politically and to bring back a notion or a proposal for having a consultative council from half of which is appointed by the king and the other half is elected. And to have an election in Saudi Arabia is a revolution. So that is how the Saudis, half revolution and half pride.
Sounds like a great formula. How about in Jordan? How about King Abdullah?
In Jordan. Jordan is more vulnerable for a number of reasons. One is that 6% of the subjects or the citizens of Jordan are of Palestinian origin. And Palestinians are the most restless population in the Middle East. And they measure any regime by its attitude toward Israel and by the hope of getting their rights back or getting back to Palestine themselves. And the king, King Abdullah of Jordan, as his father, King Hussein, have walked a very tight rope in fulfilling some of the ambitions or some of the demands of his people, but also of maintaining an easy peace with Israel. And he's continuing that. And I think, again, with the bribes from Saudi Arabia, because the Saudis, as they try to bribe Mubarak and the Egyptians, are abundantly bribing Jordan, which is on their northern border. And of course, any upheaval there will affect the Jordanian. So for the time being, the Jordanians are, even though a bit restless, and there has been demonstrations against the king, but the king immediately will effect some measures will dissolve the government, form a new cabinet. Jordan has per capita, more former cabinet members than any country in the world. Every few months, cabinet members. I think probably all my friends, except one, have been former cabinet members. So each one has his excellency on his card. Former or present excellency. And therefore, there is a great deal of circulation of the elite. And the elite are the troublemakers. The intelligentsia are the troublemakers. Now they all know that their turn to become cabinet member. And once they get out of the cabinet, they have a pension, a cabinet level pension. So the royal family in Jordan has been very smart. And that's why, you know, we haven't heard of a coup d'etat in Jordan for the last 40 years. Whereas in the first 40 years in the life of that kingdom, there was an attempted coup every 17 months. But for the last 40 years, no attempted coup d'etat. So Jordan is safe for the time being.
It's a good system. It's worth writing a book about.
Sure.
Okay, unfortunately, I've got a whole bunch of questions. We could go on forever, but Assad's got to leave here in 10 minutes to fly back to Europe and Egypt. So this is going to be the last question. Does the experience of the Arab Spring have any ramifications for Iran?
Absolutely. It does. As a matter of fact, the Arab Spring was inspired by an Iranian uprising of young people 2.5 years ago. There was an election that was perceived by the young Iranians as fraudulent, and they demonstrated. And they were using the internet to coordinate their demonstration. So the Ayatollah, that religious clergy that has been ruling Iran since 79, shut down the internet in Iran. Immediately, Egyptian youngsters, bloggers, put their blogs at the disposal of their Iranian colleagues. And that was a spontaneous, great show of solidarity, regional solidarity, among the young people of the region. And the same thing happened, by the way, with Syrians and with Israelis. So young people across borders are seeing and reading things in a similar way. And that really gives me a lot of hope for the future. So the Iranians are now agitating again, but doing it in a less confrontational manner, because the Ayatollah are brutal, and as they did 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago, they probably will do it again. So they are trying to undermine the system in all ways, of indirect ways, without being confrontational. And I think they could not be outsmarted. So I'm expecting change in Iran within the next 5 years. To the better. So I hope it will happen. Inshallah.
Inshallah. That's a great note to end it on. We all want to see change in Iran. I hope it's sooner than 5 years. Saad, this is the second Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations Cup that we've given you, and I'm sure you gave the first one to your wife, so this is for you to keep.
Oh.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Right.